you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome back to Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I am your host, Rob Kelly. And joining us this month to talk about limited collector's edition number Supergirl is, of course, Dr. Ange. Hi, Ange. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It is the summer of Supergirl. It is the month of Supergirl, and I'm thrilled to talk about this treasury.
As I was just mentioning, you were bracketing the Fire & Water Podcast Network for the month because you started the month talking about Supergirl with Paul Ken on DC Special Cast, and now we're wrapping up the month talking about Supergirl on Treasury Cast, and this truly is the month of Supergirl. Now, of course, any of you listening, most of you listening are going to know, wait a minute, what's Supergirl Treasury? There is no Supergirl Treasury because, of course, Supergirl never got a Treasury when DC was doing the Treasury. No woman, no Wonder Woman, nobody got their own Treasury. But last year, of course, when DC went all in on Superman and they not only did a Treasury, they did a brand new Treasury. I thought, well, that's what they're going to do next year for Supergirl. Maybe not something brand new, but a reprint or something. I thought that was virtually guaranteed. And then the Supergirl's pretty much upon us and no Supergirl Treasury. And that seemed like a really tremendously missed opportunity on DC's part. So I thought I would get Ange to come on and, you know, change his identity to Ange Nelson Bridwell here and craft what he would think would be the perfect Supergirl Treasury, if it was DC was publishing it today. So it's going to be, it can encompass any Supergirl story ever published up until this moment. And so I gave Ange some very limited parameters. We're not going to, this isn't going to be like one of those absolute editions that's like 400 pages. We're going to kind and limit it to the traditional Treasury format, which would be, 70 to 80 pages of material. We're going to keep it from that. And so we're going to be doing four Supergirl stories. And like I said, I was really curious to see what stories Ange is going to cover. And we will have some images from the covers to some of these books on the gallery post over on our website, of course, FireAndWaterPodcast.com. And we'll have a, you'll see the custom cover, actually covers, that I designed for this edition. And we'll get into the details of why those covers look the way they do in a moment. Before we even start getting through the stories, one question I do have for you is, because we're going to pretend that this is like getting published right now. If I had said to you, pretend this was going to get done in the 70s, right? Like when DC was actually doing the treasuries, that obviously would limit the amount of stories that you would be pulling from, because you would only have 20 years with the Supergirl stories to pull from, as opposed to now where you have many, many, many more. But I am kind of curious, you don't have to give us your runner-ups or anything like that, but if you had done a 70s one, like would some of the stories, would you have been pulling from, say, the Adventure Comics era and the Mike Sekowski stories? Are there eras that got close to this ultimate lineup that would have made it if we wouldn't be able to include more modern stories?
Yeah, for sure. Certainly the first one that we'll talk about would have stayed there because right. That one was sort of a Silver Age one. I think that I probably would have included her graduating college because I think that much like people like Peter Parker and other people like Ronnie Raymond, Firestorm, like graduating high school, that's what I mean. Graduating high school and then going to college would have been one of the ones that I picked because that's like a big sea change for her. She goes off to campus, meets new people, So I would have done that. That's sort of in the Kurt Schaffenberger, late action, early Adventure Comics stuff. I definitely would have done one of the Mike Sikowski ones, one of the early Mike Sikowski, where she gets a mod dress. She goes to Diana Prince, who at that point was depowered. Diana Prince's like dress shop to make something new. There were some bizarre stories in there, but I definitely would have picked one from early Sikowski. And then she had a very brief solo series in the early 70s after Adventure Comics, 10 issues, that the Sikowski stuff, he was definitely doing some sort of drugs. And that solo title, they were definitely doing some sort of drugs during those stories. But either the first issue, which I think is fun because she again is like starting a new life at an acting school, or one of the later issues, her hair becomes Medusa snakes. She petrifies Hawkman. She fights the Justice League, but of course, by the end, everything is well. So I probably would have included that one.
I know from your posts on social media that like the current series that's like being published now is doing a lot of riffs on those covers, right? Which is fun, right? That's neat that it's because I was looking at, like I look at the covers you post and I'm like, those are really cool looking and they're well drawn and it's kind of a nice gag in that if you get the reference, it's fun, but it works on its own, even if you don't.
Yeah, for sure. The current series, I think one of the things that is problematic with DC is they pick a creative team who either doesn't like Supergirl or doesn't know Supergirl. And so they're like, I want a story about a pirate queen in space, Supergirl. And it's like, no, Supergirl is not a pirate queen in space. You have a story about a pirate queen in space, and you just put Supergirl in that skin. But the current writer artist, Sophie Campbell, has immersed herself in Supergirl history. So has read almost everything, because if you read that book, there are Silver Age riffs, Bronze Age riffs, riffs to the Matrix Supergirl even, and it comes from a place of respect, but it isn't so deep that if you get it, it's gravy, and if you don't get it, the story still reads wonderfully. So I would recommend the current series highly. I think it's a lot of fun.
That's good. That's a good sweet spot to hit, right? That it's if you get the reference, it gives you an extra little something, but if you don't, it works on its own. That's really kind of the perfect spot. So, okay. Well, you kind of hinted at what your first story was. So, as I mentioned, we're limiting this to four stories because that would be roughly around 75 pages worth of material. So, what is the first story that you picked of the four?
The first one, believe it or not, Rob, it's a story that we've covered before on this network. It's Action Comics number 285, which was part of the Supergirl Digest.
Oh, right. When we did that on Digest Cast. Okay. All right.
Yes, in fact, Shag complained that he had to do the synopsis of this story when we reviewed it. Written by Jerry Siegel, with art by Jim Mooney, a
Morning.
legendary artist for Supergirl. It's a two-parter called The World's Greatest Heroine in Part One and The Infinite Monster in Part Two. And my brief synopsis, as brief as I can make it, Superman finally decides that Supergirl has trained enough and is ready to be revealed to the world. The first step is to tell her foster parents slash adopted parents, the Danvers. That reveal comes a little bit earlier than expected, and without Superman being present, when Supergirl is forced to save them when their car crashes through a rickety wooden bridge, which seemed to be everywhere in the DCU at that time. Superman arrives, and after a quick recap of Kara's origins to the Danvers, he makes them vow to keep her secret, and then the two heroes are off for celebration. Superman overrides all of the world's broadcasts to announce Supergirl's very existence to the entirety of the world. Jealous actresses, circus strongmen, criminals, and even Nikita Khrushchev are all very upset to learn that a Supergirl is out there. But everyone else, the UN, Kandor, Atlantis, and countless other worlds, are overjoyed. Now, during her first time protecting the Earth solo, with Superman off traveling in space, Supergirl is forced to fight an enormous force field protected kaiju. And initially, she can't defeat it, inciting some casual misogyny. But with a little help from the Legion and her own ingenuity, she wins the day, cementing herself as the hero that the world needs.
All right. So when you sent me the list, I was surprised that you did not go with her first appearance. That seems like an obvious point to start of any treasury. So why did you go for this one as opposed to her first appearance?
Yeah, I felt like what I wanted to do in this treasury is bring stories that are sort of major turning points for her character in all of the different eras. Like, when is there a new sort of like time that you can sort of jump on board? And this was a major turning point for the character. You know, she was going from being a hero in hiding, Superman's secret weapon, afraid that she'll disappoint Superman, like hiding in the orphanage, to being an out in the open hero, kind of beloved by everybody. And then with this now revealed to the world status, she can move on to other things. So she can graduate high school and go to college. She can get her own arch villains. There are just more stories that are possible for her. But outside of that, I would say the cover of this, of Superman and Supergirl flying and her being welcomed by the world, is probably, I would say, the third most famous Supergirl image that's out there. The first being, of course, the cover of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Mm-hmm. The second being, of course, her first appearance cover flying out of that purple rocket. But this has been shown in countless other comics. Whenever they talk about Supergirl's origin, there's always a shot of her and Superman holding hands and flying. It's been on t-shirts. It's actually even referenced. The story is referenced in Crisis on Infinite Earths when Superman is carrying her dead body into space. He says, "I can remember the day that I revealed you to the world. I was so proud of you." So this is kind of like a pretty big Silver Age story for her. And moreover, you can just really feel Supergirl's joy in this story. She is so happy to be now, without worry, I can go out and help people and really be the superhero that I am. So that's just great. I mean, throw in JFK and Jackie O and Nikita Khrushchev.
Nikita Khrushchev.
And it's just like, I don't think you can beat this story. This is like a really good story.
Okay, fair enough. Fair. By the way, you mentioned the Crisis thing, and just randomly the other day I was in a store just picking up, I don't know, like groceries or something, and this place also sells TVs, and they were like Vizio TVs, and on the box they have like instead of having, you know, on the box for the TV is the picture of the TV that you're buying, and I guess so they don't have a blank screen, they want to put something on there, and they have an image of the Crisis animated movie, and it's the image of Supergirl laying there with Superman, you know, holding her and crying, and I'm like, that's on the box of a television now. Like, you think
that's
about it,
crazy.
What it's like, that was an image that only nerds like us knew, and now that's on the box of a TV that you're gonna drop $500 for. I was like, what? This is crazy. You know? Like,
yeah,
this is
yeah.
Insane.
I mean, there's no escaping Crisis 7 homages. They are like everywhere.
Wow. So, okay. All right. Well, that was exactly why I wanted you on to, other than not just have a list, was to explain why you picked the ones you did. Because my, you know, not being an expert at all on Supergirl, I would have started with the first appearance, you know, coming out of the rocket and stuff. But this makes a lot of sense. So that's a great pick. So, okay. So what's your second pick?
All right. So the second pick is, we're going to move forward to the early 80s to The Daring New Adventures of Supergirl #1, by writer Paul Kupperberg, artist Carmen Infantino, and inker Bob Oxner. And I got to tell you, Oxner on Infantino is a win.
That's good stuff. That's
overall
good stuff.
That is just good stuff. He really makes late Infantino look good. The synopsis of this story is the title of the story is A Strange and Special Girl. And this one is even briefer, but during her move to Chicago to start the next chapter in her life as a grad student studying criminal psychology, Linda Supergirl Danvers recalls her origin, meets new friends, moves into a new apartment, and ultimately fights the psionic villain Psy, who is hoping to stave off ultimate decay in the Windy City.
Okay. All right. So what, I mean, this one's, I think, relatively obvious. Even someone like me, who was not like the biggest Supergirl fan, I bought this series. I remember buying this one, but what, so why'd you go with this one?
You know, I think one of the themes that you're going to hear as we go over all of these stories is there comes a time in Supergirl stories in comic continuity where she just needs a soft reboot. There's just they bring in different writers who just do different things to her, and at some point they're like, we've sort of lost our way with the character. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of like a true soft reboot. You know, she's a great character. She's got the powers of Superman, but she's more malleable than Superman, right? She's a young hero. She's still learning. She's a little bit fallible, but she's filled with hope. She wants to spare others from all of the stuff that she's had to deal with. And if you look back immediately before this, right, through Adventure Comics and then that solo series and then the Superman Family series, she was like in college and then a camera person in San Francisco on a news crew and then guidance counselor at a fancy school and then like a soap opera actress, right? And then
that's my favorite one.
Yeah, she's just like all over the map. And I think Paul Kupperberg was like, we kind of just have to get back to basics here a little bit. And so really without any sort of explanation, this issue like de-ages her. She can't have worked for years as a camera person and a guidance counselor and a soap opera actress, right? She would be in her mid-30s. She can't be that because then she'd be, Superman would be in his mid-40s. They didn't want to do that.
Can't and do so that, just right.
Without mention, without any sort of explanation, she's in her early 20s again. She's going to grad school, right? So he just de-ages her. But he kind of keeps her heroic experience intact. So she isn't like, I'm brand new to this game. She is like a very established superhero at this point. She's not a sidekick or an emergency secret weapon. She feels she can be like, I am going to be the superhero that defends a big city like Chicago without anybody else needing to be here. This is my city. And so she has a new locale. She's de-aged. She's sort of back to basics. And because it's a new town, she gets a new supporting cast. She gets new villains like Psy and the Gang.
The Gang.
Right? And Reactron. Some of those characters have pulled forward in every other iteration of Supergirl that has happened since then. So make fun of Reactron. He was on the television show. He was a huge part of the new Krypton storyline. He's been like everywhere. And so I just think this is another great sort of place that if you didn't know the character, you would pick this up. And she's just charming in this. And there are things like Kupperberg just sort of got it, right? Where he says, you know, he says, from the debris of the catastrophe rose hope, like the phoenix from the flame, hope for the myriad beings of the universe and a blessing for the planet Earth, right? Like this is not somebody who's defined by her trauma or wallowing in her trauma. You know, she has like, she just wants to help people because of that. And so I just think it's wonderful. It also has, I don't know what you're going to say, but there's this great like Mary Tyler Moore panel where like, she's like, you know, you're going to make it after all, kid, you know, like I just hear that music in my head whenever I see that like she's walking through the city, you know, and it's really lovely. Oxnard has her dressed up quite beautifully throughout this entire series. She gets into a couple of scrapes during this issue. I can't imagine anybody who would read that and say, I don't think I'm going to pick up the next issue. She really is just charming and joyful and fierce in her determination to help people. I think it's great.
All right. Very, very good. Now, in your quick opinion, how long did Daring New Adventures run? About like 2 years?
Yeah, 23-ish.
It's almost exactly. Okay. Almost exactly 2 years. Were there better issues? Are there more favorite issues in that series than the first one? Or, you know what I mean? Like you picked the first one because it's the first one, but did it like in your mind, were there other issues that were maybe in the mix? And it's just let's do the first one because it establishes so many things.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great little story sort of in the middle of the series where She gets overwhelmed with radiation sickness because of her fight with Reactron. She goes to the fortress to try to cure herself. At some point, somebody had cloned her, and all of these mini versions of Supergirl try to kill her, throw her into the atomic cauldron, which is a deep cut for Superman fans. And she comes out, and she like needs a new costume, and that's where the Crisis costume comes into play.
Okay.
One of the things that I thought about doing, of course, the first issue that we talked about is her classic blue miniskirt Silver Age stuff. And this one is the 70s, the hot pants and halter top. But I thought about that middle, one of those middle issues that would be like, oh, this is clearly the transition from we're leaving that 70s period and we're moving into this like pre-crisis period. She's got that new costume and all of those things.
Okay. I'm gonna guess because we're about to jump. We jumped 20 years between your first pick and your second pick, and we're about to jump about 25 years. I'm gonna guess that Crisis number 7 was never gonna be in the mix because A, the book is like 48 pages and it would have taken up like a lot of room. But also, it's just that she's only in it for like 8 pages out of that whole book. It's a great moment, but it's. I could see why you're like, well, but yeah, but the rest of it is not Supergirl, even though that's a very significant moment in her history.
If I could have, it's a double-sized issue. If you had said, it's fine with me to just put the back end of Crisis in, because the front end of Crisis 7 is all exposition dump about how the Anti-Monitor comes around, like what happened all of those millions of years, all of that sort of stuff. The second half is we're going to fight the Anti-Monitor in the fortress. She's great throughout that. She's like... She's a really smart fighter. She, figures out how to delay his rock creatures from reassembling. Defends Superman, comes within a whisker of really killing the Anti-Monitor.
Really beats the living snot out of him.
Beats the snot out of him. And probably would have finished things if she hadn't been distracted by Dr. Light.
Stupid Dr. Light!
Yes, stupid Dr. Light, right. But... Yeah, it would have been very interesting to sort of put that in. I wanted to sort of celebrate the character, as I have told you, there's this feeling among Supergirl fans that it's like people who don't get the character probably were the ones that said she's expendable. And part of the problem is they kept. Like there was no set history for her, right? Everything was almost too malleable. And so, it's kind of easy to sort of say like, we can get rid of her. So I really wanted to celebrate the character a little bit more.
Makes total sense. All right. So what's their third pick?
Yeah. Now we're really shooting forward, right? Because she dies in Crisis in 1986. She doesn't come back till 2004. If we're talking Kara Zor-El, and we can talk about other things after. And so the next issue that I picked is Supergirl number 34 in the sort of like reboot, bringing her back, Jeff Loeb, Michael Turner character. So Supergirl number 34 by writer Sterling Gates, artist Jamal Igel, inker Keith Champagne in a book titled The World Doesn't Need Supergirl. And the synopsis is as follows. The Daily Planet has run a front page story written by Cat Grant with the headline, The World Doesn't Need Supergirl, hence the title of the story. The story in The Planet talks about how irresponsible and dangerous Supergirl is, bringing up some past misdeeds. That very night, Supergirl fights the Silver Banshee, but the brawl lands her in the middle of the field of an ongoing Metropolis Monarchs baseball game. The Banshee is defeated, but the crowd at the Supergirl boos, the crowd at the baseball field boos Supergirl, many of them chanting that the Daily Planet is right in that editorial piece. Flying off and seeing the newspaper, Supergirl sulks all night until Superman comes in with some encouraging words. Kara is a hero. She is worthy of the S shield that she wears. She just might be trying a little bit too hard. Maybe it's time to get a secret identity and have a little bit of a life outside of only being Supergirl. Talking to the Titans, Wonder Woman, the Kents, and finally Lana Lang, Supergirl makes a decision. She will become Linda Lang and live in Metropolis with her aunt, Lana Lang, and rededicate herself and her life to become a better hero.
All right. So now why number 34 of this series of Supergirl volume, like 17 or whatever it was at this
point? Yeah, I think it's the Supergirl. I think it's probably Supergirl volume because they count the miniseries. So I think it's Supergirl volume 5. Number 34 because numbers 1 through 32, 33 are not very good.
Wow. Okay. All right.
So here's what I'll say. So Jeff Loeb and Michael Turner go to Dan Didio and say, we just got to bring back Kara Zor-El. We really want to get back to the classics here. And so those two creators do a story in Batman Superman and then kick off Supergirl's solo title. And the character for a brief period of time is red hot. But the early issues of this run are like rough. If you read those early issues, it's almost like a TNA book. And she's supposed to be like 16 at the time.
Oh,
the
wow.
art is okay. very lurid. There's a lot of upskirt shots.
Oh, ew.
There's like, she says things like, why do people stare at my S? Right. Yeah. It's like pretty rough. And not only that, the character herself, like one of the things that I feel about the character that I love is that, again, she is hopeful and joyous and wants to help people. And the early issues of this book is she's just like mean. At times she's angry. At times she doesn't want to be a hero. Loeb leaves the book very early on. There's a bunch of fill-in issues. Then Joe Kelly comes on. And I usually like Joe Kelly's work, but he gives us this long-form story where Zor-El on Krypton believes that people are being possessed by phantoms from the Phantom Zone and convinces Kara to join him to kill those people. There's actually an issue where she goes to a Kryptonian high school and shoots the place up, like really insane stories. And then when Supergirl fans complained about his approach, there's actually an issue, one of his last issues, where it's basically like yelling at fans like, that old version of Supergirl really sucked, why don't you like get on with it? And then he leaves, and then they bring in Kelly Puckett, who writes a decent story, but a story where Supergirl promises a kid with brain cancer that she will cure him of his brain cancer, and she can't, and he dies.
My God.
And so there's this like nearly 3-year period of stories that I just couldn't stand. In fact, Rob, the reason why I started my blog was I hated those stories so much that I said, somebody has to celebrate this character. They're really writing these terrible stories about her that are not who this character is. Like, somebody has to celebrate this character. And I guess that's going to be me. And so, like, literally, that is why my blog started. And so issue 34 is like time for a bold new direction. Like it's just time to leave the angry, bitter TNA, all that stuff behind. Let's get people that actually like the character. Sterling Gates is a complete newcomer at this time. If you look, I think he had like one backup, like Green Lantern core story to his credit before he gets put on as writer of Supergirl. Jamal Igel is kind of a veteran at this point, but they dedicate themselves. They're like, we're going to eliminate this yucky stuff, and we're just going to have her be likable. She's going to be a young hero, surely, completely learning the ropes, making mistakes, can be fallible, but she's trying, and she's really trying hard to be a hero. I think their run, which goes from 34 to, I think, 58, is almost like a high watermark for the character in total long form. If we're talking about Kara Zor-El. But their run is derailed because literally this is number 34. 35 is the beginning of the new Krypton storyline. And her book gets hijacked by this major event for like the next year. But they got her. They just got her. And they did small things like they put bike shorts on underneath her skirt because there were all these shots of her like wearing a thong and like they made, she was wearing like a belly shirt that was really more like a sports bra, but they like lowered it and they just had her be a hero that was proud of who she was. So that's why this I felt was a true, you know, this is the jumping on point. You shouldn't read the stuff that happened before. start reading here.
All right. That's, I had no idea about all the history. I had no clue. So that's really good. That's really great. I say it's a great cover, by the way. You'll be able to, again, you just see it in the gallery post accompanying.
Early Joshua Middleton, like before he blew up, he did a bunch of covers for that title. Great
Good
stuff.
stuff. All right. So, okay. So what is your last pick for the Supergirl treasure?
Yeah. So I think we're probably going to go forward. That I think is the Gates thing, I think is
2008, right?
2008. And then I'm doing Rebirth, which I think is about 10 years later, 2017 maybe. So I am doing the Supergirl Rebirth Special number one by writer Steve Orlando and artist Emanuela Lupacino. And the title of this is simply Supergirl Rebirth. And the synopsis is as follows. A powerless Supergirl is put in a DEO rocket powered by a phantom drive and shot to the sun in hopes of reigniting her powers. DEO head Cameron Chase and DEO agents Jeremiah Eliza Danvers are hopeful this will cure the Girl of Steel. But the phantom drive opens up a rift into the phantom zone and out pops really deep cut character, Kryptonian werewolf Lar-On, who had been sent to the Phantom Zone by Kara's father back on Argo City. Supergirl's powers do return in the sun and she flies back to Earth and battles Lar-On. But during the battle, she's constantly trying to calm him down. She tells him she knows what it means to be feared and she knows what it feels like to be alone and to feel abandoned, and she promises that she will never let him feel that way. She picks him up and flies him to the sunny side of the earth where he transforms back into his humanoid form. Because they returned her powers, the DEO makes Supergirl work for them as an agent. She will now become Kara Danvers, living with Jeremiah and Eliza Danvers, learning to relate to humans, becoming a student at National City High School, and defending the earth whenever called upon.
All right. Now, before we get to why you picked this one, much like we did this time last year when I had Michael Bailey school me a little bit about how there are super sons now, like how's that
Yeah.
a thing? I had pieced out of DC Comics before Rebirth. So can you very quickly explain to me what Rebirth even was? Because I have no idea what that whole movement was.
Yeah.
Is it new continuity? Is it what was it?
So they make the new 52,
Right.
right?
That's the last
And
one I was there for.
they're going to reboot everything. And literally 4 years into the new 52, I think they were like, boy, we made like a real big mistake. Like we have to get back to the classic versions of these characters. And so there is Geoff Johns does a rebirth special. It's kind of hinted that maybe Dr. Manhattan has like played a little nookie with the universe, but it's okay, Rob, because I don't care why they got back to the classics. They just got back to the classics. And it's kind of tough because it's like a little bit of a brand new universe, but maybe some pieces of the continuity of New 52 move forward. But it
Okay.
overall felt like new. There was like she is powerless in this, I think, because in the last story before the end of the New 52, when like there's an old Superman from a convergence pocket universe who merges with the New 52 Superman, and there's some fight with Doomsday, and I think she loses her powers there. And so that sort of pulls forward. But much of everything else that happened in the New 52, things like Superman and Wonder Woman banging each other, just gets forgotten. And
Okay, well that I'm gonna support. Yeah.
thankfully, right? You
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
and so it's sort of like time. And I think that they did a decent job, DC, that is that every title that they were bringing back got a rebirth special. So this, much like New 50, like the point of New 52 for Dan Didio was like, you don't have to know all of the continuity. You can just, join up, right? You know,
Like your imitation of Dan Didio. It sounds like Scooby-Doo. Like, what is that? Okay. All right.
these are all like jumping on points. Look, pick up this rebirth special. You can get a sense of what the title is going to be like as it moves forward.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for explaining that, 'cause I by that point I was done with just buying
Yeah.
my comics, and I was like, Are they rebooting it again? I was just like, what is happening? So, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. So why did you pick Supergirl Rebirth to close out the treasury?
Yeah, it's another kind of soft reboot and sort of redirection issue. So we talked about the New 52 era, and DC is sort of putting them behind them. But that means that, like, we need a new Supergirl. And then if you take a look at the New 52 Supergirl, you can sort of understand why they needed to change. That New 52 Supergirl starts out, she hates Superman. She doesn't want to learn English. She speaks Kryptonian, so she can't communicate with anybody. She wants to have a fortress of solitude at the bottom of the ocean so she doesn't have to talk to people. She flies off into space. She
I
gets
can
so.
appreciate that.
Yeah. Right. But all it's like, let me read a superhero comic where somebody's sulking at the bottom of the ocean. Like, it's no good, right? Like, you want a hopeful, joyful, heroic
That's what I
Supergirl,
read
not.
Aquaman for. What am I,
Yeah,
why
right.
is this in my
Yeah.
Supergirl?
Not an angry, bitter, but it gets even crazier, right? They make her a Red Lantern. She's so filled with rage, she becomes a Red Lantern. And what's funny
What?
is that ultimately they say, like, this is not the right direction to go. They bring Tony Bedard on as writer, and he actually makes the Red Lantern story almost a redemption story. All of these people are like, what are you doing? This isn't you. This isn't who you are. She, like, casts off the Red Lantern. But by then, I think the book is in, like, the death throes of sales. There's an arc where they send her into deep space again to join a sort of, like, science fiction Hogwarts, and the book gets canceled. So this is like, let's have her be young again, want to be a hero again, be on Earth. But the other thing that I find interesting is that at this time when this comes out, the Supergirl television show is on.
Oh,
And
right.
so they actually are bringing in elements of the Supergirl television show into this. So they're leaning into classic comic Supergirl again, young hero in high school, learning, caring, but she lives in National City. That was the city she lived in the television show. She works for the DEO. That's what she did on the television show. Her parents are Jeremiah and Eliza Danvers, DEO agents. That's from the television show. And so it's folding in. There might have been people out there that were like, I like this television show, let me read the comics. Steve Orlando kind of knew the mission. He needed to make He wrote a compassionate Supergirl who, like, really wants to help people, and she might beat you up if you're being bad, but she'll also visit you in prison and try to help reform you, and she'll try to figure out a solution before fighting you if she has to. But ultimately, I think he tried to do too much. It was like there's too much television show and too much young hero stuff, and the book kind of felt stretched for a while, as if he was trying to, like, accomplish too much. But still, I would say a very, very good series. He brought in a lot of old villains, and wrote her wonderfully.
Okay, so the rundown for everybody for this treasury. This is what Ange would pick for a Supergirl treasury. Action Comics number 285 from February 1962, The World's Greatest Heroine. Daring New Adventures of Supergirl number 1 from November 1982, A Very Strange and Special Girl. Supergirl number 34 from December 2008, Why the World Doesn't Need Supergirl. And Supergirl Rebirth number 1 from October 2016, simply called Rebirth. Now, was there any story that was like a close, was like number five is right outside the window that you just had to cut for time or space, or was it were the did this sort of these four, kind of like fall plinko their way down and you're like, no, it was basically these four.
Yeah, it for the purpose of a treasury, I think these four kind of bubbled up. If you
Okay.
ask me, like, what are my favorite stories, one of the last arcs by Sterling Gates is called Bizarro Girl. That is just absolutely fantastic. And at that point, the new Krypton planet had blown up. She literally lost, like, both of her parents come back into her life, and then both are subsequently killed. And she has to sort of shake off the doldrums and become a hero again. That probably would have been in there. And I'm trying to think, if I could squeeze in the first issue of the current series, I might try to do that. But I think when you told me what you were looking for, these were the four that kind of just immediately sprang to mind.
Okay, right. I was trying to play fair of like, you know, let's try and keep it to some known reality that the Treasury would be 80 pages and not 230, because then it would never get published, because then it's a phone book and it's retailing for $49.95 and whatever. Now, if you look again, everybody, if you look at the gallery, you will see two covers for this Treasury, and you will see a Supergirl word puzzle that I had Ange help me write, because he was able to give me some characters from the Supergirl mythos that I was not familiar with. And so, kind of in keeping with the tradition of the old Treasuries, there is a Supergirl word puzzle, and all the names are in there, by the way. I don't have a key or anything, but all the names are in there. They go in any direction, but if you want to print that out and just kill some time doing Supergirl world puzzle, there it is. Now, you may be wondering why there are two covers. Okay. Because I wrote to Ange and I said, Ange, who is your favorite Supergirl artist? Because I figured that's the artist I would use for the cover. I already knew what design I wanted to do in terms of the covers and the background and a surprint, but then I wanted to have a main image. And you said, Ange, who?
Yeah, I think he said, who is the person that, whose version you really, really loved? It's tough. That favorite is a strong word.
But okay.
I talked about Gary Frank, because I love Gary Frank's art, and he did he did some issues of Supergirl in the past, and if I could meet Gary Frank in person, I would beg him for a sketch. And so that's why I sort of said him.
Okay, so you said Gary Frank. So I go looking for images of Supergirl drawn by Gary Frank to use as a main image. So I'm looking, and I'm trying to find an iconic pose, something I can easily kind of clip and manipulate, and you know, that it'll work as a cover image. I don't want her punching. I want her kind of flying or something. So I find this one image. I'm like, perfect. I compose the cover. I put it together. I sent it to Ange, and then you informed me what?
Yeah, that's not Kara Zor-El. It's Supergirl, but it is the Matrix Supergirl, because he drew the first nine issues of the Peter David Matrix Supergirl story.
Now, I knew of that. I knew that there was that clone, but I just did not know that was the one I was drawing, that one that I was pulling from. And I initially was going to leave it alone. And then, because I'm a nerd, it just bothered me. I'm like, no, if it's a Supergirl Treasury, the cover has to have Supergirl on it, not the clone. So I yanked that, and I decided to pull an image of Adam of Supergirl by Adam Hughes from the Rebirth number one. Adam Hughes, you know, one of the, obviously marvelous cover artists. So I pulled that, but I realized that you said you wanted to, you had your own reasons why you wanted to keep that Gary Frank one. So I decided, okay, well, if we're going to pretend there's a Supergirl Treasury, let's pretend that there are two covers for it. What the hell? I mean, they're doing that now with the Treasuries anyway, with the foil covers or whatever that crazy crap they're doing. So that's why there are two variant covers to this fake Supergirl Treasury in the gallery, if you're wondering.
For sure, for sure. And one of the things that I asked you was that, could I get one page to do sort of an angry rant editorial like Alex Toth did in the Super Friends Treasury, which I just think is great. Like, it's the Super Friends. And I think at one point he's like, I had to yell at a bunch of people in the office who tried to make me draw differently. The hell with those people. I'm like, this is the Super Friends. But okay. So give me 2 minutes if I can, and I will read you this editorial that I wrote.
Of course.
All right. The title of the editorial is The Giant Babooch in the Room. Okay. If you are holding the Gary Frank variant cover of this Treasury in your hand, you need to know that image is not one of Kara Zor-El. That is the Matrix Supergirl. The Matrix Supergirl was not a Kryptonian. She was a proto-matter being from a pocket universe who ultimately gained Earth angelic powers. And yes, that sounds confusing, but those stories are fantastic, and I recommend that you seek them out. But the Matrix Supergirl was in the DCU between 1988 through 2004 because Kara Zor-El was dead. And that is the elephant, the Kryptonian babooch in the room. DC didn't think Supergirl was a great character. She was redundant. She was Superman with boobs or a barnacle on the Superman mythos. And after several decades of up and down stories and an unstable base for the character, as well as a failed movie, DC decided to kill her. She was so expendable that she could be killed off and stay dead for nearly 20 years. But part of that expendability has to be laid at the feet of the DC offices. The core of this character is this: a young hero learning her trade, still fallible, living in the immense shadow of Superman, but bringing a brightness and hope to all her adventures. That's simply who Supergirl is. She has dealt with the loss of her planet, and that makes her fierce in her mission and devoted to her heroism to make sure no one else suffers like that. And while you feel that undercurrent in all of her stories, DC simply couldn't pin down the rest of it. She was a sweet young girl in an orphanage, or a college student, or a camerawoman, or an acting student, or a guidance counselor, or a soap opera actress, or a grad student. And every change meant a new location with new cast members and new problems. Every change seemed to age her more, while Superman stayed the same age. You blink, and it was time for a new Supergirl direction. So no wonder long-term fans were dedicated, but few, because Supergirl just seemed to keep changing. And when DC decided to bring back a Kryptonian cousin of Supergirl, they picked creators who didn't recognize that core. Everyone seemed to think they needed to differentiate her from Superman by making her angry or saucy or sullen. She didn't want to be a hero or live up to the weight of the S-Shield. And that is the inherent problem with everything. Fans of bad girls don't want to read Supergirl. And Supergirl fans don't want her to be a bad girl. But creators keep going to that well. Let's make Supergirl dark again. And it never works. Longtime fans wonder if they'll kill her off yet again. But usually it is a course correction back to that ideal Supergirl, and that's why you are reading the issues of this Treasury. Action 285 shows a new direction of her being an out-in-the-open hero. Daring New Adventures brings us to a younger hero dedicating her life to her adopted world. Supergirl number 34 starts the Sterling Gage Jamal Igel run, where Supergirl admits she might punch too early but is determined to keep Earth safe. Gates created Kara's credo, not truth, justice, in the American way, but hope, help, and compassion for all. And then Supergirl Rebirth starts Steve Orlando's run, where she is a hero who might bring you to justice, but is going to help you afterwards. As she says in that issue, let me help you. I won't abandon you. That is who Supergirl is, not someone wallowing in her trauma or trapped by her history. She's a hero, and that's why she should be celebrated. And so, Rob, I'm saying it, and I'm playing it straight.
That is marvelous, Ange. I love that. I can totally picture that on the inside front cover, right? On the thing. Now, would you have done it like Alex Toth and that it's like it's done in your handwriting? Or do you have typical doctor handwriting, which is illegible?
Oh, yeah. I don't think I would ever. I don't think you could read my handwriting.
Okay.
It's cursive, but it really looks like shorthand cursive that nobody else can read.
All right. So this would be typeset then. Okay. That's fair. Yeah. That's fine. Or we'll hire a letterer to do it. Okay. And that is great. You went above and beyond the call. I just picking the stories I thought was enough of a request from you, but you really went above and beyond to write the little Ange Nelson Bridwell editorial. So that is fantastic. Look, the Fire and Water Network makes things happen. It just does. It just got announced today, or basically a couple of days ago by the time people hear this, that DC is doing a facsimile edition of the DC special Joe Kubert, all Joe Kubert issue, which Paul Kinn and I talked about on DC Special Cast, and we've got the Treasuries back. So the Firewater Network makes things happen. So even though it would have really made the most sense to put out a Supergirl Treasury this month in time with the movie, who knows, right? And maybe this lineup of stories from the Supergirl expert will maybe lead to an actual Supergirl Treasury down the line. If the movie is a huge, huge hit, like it's a monster hit, maybe DC will say, you know what, we can just do a Supergirl Treasury later on or something. And maybe this will be a nice template for them to follow. So we're putting it out there in the ether that if DC, you want to do a Supergirl Treasury, this would be a great way to do it.
This would be a great way to do it. And by all means, they can contact me if they want me to give them any other tips or tricks about how to deal with this character.
That would be absolutely fantastic. So by the time if you're listening to this, everybody, we are about a week out from the movie debuting. Some critics have seen it. And some reviews are trickling in, and they actually seem to be pretty positive. And in a way, and we're not giving anything away. I don't know anything about the movie or anything like that. But the reviews, from what I've seen, really initial takes seem to be, oh, this is not the movie that the previews are selling. It's a more interesting movie than what you think you're going to get from the trailers, which that's good, right? I think it's always good if you go to a movie and it's more or different than what you've been sold. So I have my tickets. We will be seeing the movie the weekend it comes out. I'm really excited. I mean, I'm sorry, Ange, that we weren't able to create a groundswell to get you to the premiere. We retweeted at James Gunn as best we could, but I don't know. How are you feeling about the movie now that it's imminent?
Yeah, I keep saying that I am not a fan of the Tom King book the template, but right. I keep hearing, like, even the director said, like, yeah, that was our starting point and parts of the story are there, but it's not a beat for beat thing. And I just think that in the end, it just has to end hopeful. That as I've said before, I think Lobo is going to be like, she's going to look at Lobo and say, man, I can't become like that. And so maybe I need to like course correct here. And I think that, and then of course she's probably going to save the little girl. And so I think that end will be very, very hopeful. There's a spot in the commercial I've said before where like the sun is shining behind her and she's smiling and she's in the Supergirl shirt. That has to be the end shot. In my mind, there's going to be like Superman getting the snot kicked out of him by Metallo, or Metallo suddenly flies off. He looks over his shoulder and there she is smiling and hovering like, I'm back, and I'm here to do some good. So I actually feel oddly hopeful about it. I actually have like my vibes are good about it, which is crazy because I loathe that miniseries.
Right. Okay. So. All right. Well, Ange, thank you for doing this. This was something I wanted to do. Like, ever since they announced the Supergirl movie, I sort of had this notion in my head of like, oh man, there should have been a Supergirl treasury, and there's only one person I would ask to compile it. So thank you so much for going on this little adventure with me and putting all this together. I really appreciate all that. You're a very busy man. You're out there saving lives, and I really appreciate you took time out to not only just do the show with me, but do all this legwork and stuff and put this together. So thank you very much, my friend.
Yeah, this was an absolute joy. I mean, like, it really got me to think hard about the character. And honestly, it is sort of trying to pick out, which gem is the one that you really want to showcase. And I wanted to sort of do the different periods of her character because we've gone through so many continuities now. So I relished the homework. It was a wonderful way to clean out the cobwebs in my mind after a tough month of shifts.
Good. And I will say, I didn't instruct you to do this because this is a fantasy. It doesn't matter. But I would genuinely say that this lineup of stories that you picked is like fairly commercial, right? Because you've got two modern stories and then one sort of like iconic one and then one more classic one, The Daring Adventures. But that, that comic's 45 years old at this point. Yeah. So like this is not – like if someone come to me and said, do an Aquaman treasury, I would have picked a bunch of stories that they would never publish in a treasury. Right? They would just never, they'd be like, no one's going to buy this but you. But I actually think this lineup of stories is something you could genuinely market to people that would want to buy it. Of like, hey, you're going to get two recent stories, within reason, one sort of a Bronze Age one, and then one classic one from her early days. So I actually think this would be a genuinely really solid collection of stories. So again, DC, if you ever want to do Supergirl treasury and you want to use this template, go right ahead. We're giving it to you for free, everybody. Just like get Ange to do an editorial like you just did for the intro. So, okay, Ange, why don't you tell people where they can find you right on the internet?
Yeah, I'm still at my site, which is called Comic Box Commentary, and I review Supergirl and all of the Superman books and occasionally get some Legion in there. And I am still on X and Blue Sky at Dr. Ange 70.
All right. Excellent. Well, again, I'm sure we will talk between now and then, but good luck to you. Supergirl movie. I hope you have fun. I hope I hope it's just a fun experience. I remembered being in the theater for the Aquaman movie. I'm like, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe this is a thing that's happening. So now you get to experience it. So it's great. So everybody, thank you for listening. I want you to stay tuned. We're going to run some commercials. And when I come back, we're going to do some listener feedback.
Crepe Minerva. It's something new.
It's underoos. It's a real change of underwear.
Wearing underoos is fun.
And you can choose from more than one.
There's Veronica
and Josie too.
underwear. Yes, yeah, something super new in underwear.
You'll find fashion underwear for you by underwear. Underwear that's fun to wear.
Across the DC multiverse, countless worlds exist in parallel, each with its own history, its own heroes, its own destiny. I'm DC Dave, and this is Infinite Earths, a guide to the DC multiverse, a travel log and field guide to the worlds beyond the familiar. Each episode, we chart a different Earth, exploring its origins, its defining stories, and the cosmic architecture that shaped it. From the earliest multiverse experiments to the mythic forces that rewrote reality itself, every world has a place on the map. The Orrery is waiting. Join me. Let's explore.
And now we're back with listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the previous episode of Treasury Cast number 104, The Untold Legends of Batman, with my pal and fellow network all-star Chris Franklin. Rob McCarthy says, I do like the other thugs killing Joe Chill, but I wouldn't write it. And then he details his version of it. You can read that on the site. Professor Chuck Coletta, guest on this very show, said, I'm so glad you decided to do an episode looking at The Untold Legend of the Batman, which is truly my absolute favorite story featuring the Caped Crusader. I stumbled upon a very used copy in the early 80s at the dawn of my comics fandom and was forever hooked on Aparo. The joy in your voices was nice to hear. I know this will never happen, but if I could treasury size some old comics, my top three would include 1, The Phantom Zone 1982 miniseries by Steve Gerber and Gene Colan; 2, The Krypton Chronicles 1981 miniseries by Bridwell and Swan. I happily devoured those issues. 3, a reprint of Detective Comics 526 from 1983. It is a special giant-sized issue that commemorates Batman's 500th appearance in the series and features the first appearance of Jason Todd as Robin. Great Don Newton art. Yeah, co-signed to all of those. That would be really fun. But yeah, I had that issue of Detective, and it's terrific. He goes on, he says, Chris, I'm excited to know what you're cooking up. Yes, we all really are waiting with bated breath for Chris to launch the show. It's going to be great. One other quick item. I've never forgotten Jack Edison and his connection to the Batmobile from this issue. I always wanted to see more of him. Also, I'm probably in the minority, but I really do prefer Alfred meeting Bruce as an adult. I've never bought the idea of him turning into a father figure for Bruce. I dislike even more of making him a man of action. Yeah, the man of action stuff is kind of, I roll my eyes a little bit, like everyone has to have like a big backstory. I don't mind him meeting Bruce as a young man, but maybe not a father figure, like an uncle. I don't know. Like, I know what you're saying, Chuck. It's kind of like, I don't want him to be like a surrogate dad. It's that hole in Bruce's life that makes him be Batman. If Alfred fills in, then he kind of doesn't have that. So anyway, thanks for commenting. Super Captain says, thank you for covering this book. I think I had the first issue back in the day, and I know that I had the second one. That panel of the villain flashcards dumped on the table is seared into my brain. But I never had the final issue, and I did not read the conclusion until getting this Treasury edition. I was a little underwhelmed by the Batman was hallucinating from being bonked on the head explanation, but I was happy to get the end of the story after 40 plus years. Great job as always, Rob, and I too am looking forward to hearing about the future plans Chris mentioned. Chris, you hear that? Everyone's waiting. Get on it. Ryan Daly from this very network says, fun discussion, guys. I could listen to Chris talk about Batman every month. I picked up the new Superman Treasury last summer, but haven't gotten any of the other facsimile or new books yet. I think I might have to grab a few next time I'm at a comic store. Yes, Ryan, please do that. Martin Gray says, seconded on Alfred, Chuck. What's wrong with the Shakespearean actor turned butler? That's handy for teaching Batman about undercover work. I don't mind him having had a wartime fling with Michelle Marie, but an SAS man who doubles as a surgeon? Too much. And ditto Leslie Thompson, Tompkins, give me a kind old lady who helped Bruce when he needed it most, but was brown bread by the time he debuted as Batman. A doctor? Nah, Dr. Douglas Dundee can fill in for both modern Batman and Leslie when it comes to fixing the broken bones. Scott Arthur says, Bruce was shown wearing the Robin costume in 1955 in Detective Comics number 226. Thomas Wayne was revealed to be the first Batman in 1956 and Detective 235. You know, Scott, like, those stories are part of classic continuity when they go that far back, but I just don't like them. I'm just like, it's a little too much. But he continues on. The first story was only reprinted in an early annual before the 80-page Giants, but the second story was reprinted several times, including less than a year before this miniseries in Best of DC Digest number 2. I bought this miniseries off the rack in 1980. I'm old. If you're old, what does that make me, Scott? And still have them somewhere. I'll try to dig them out to see if any of them had the table of contents you mentioned. What I do remember about the time was that it was shortly before Marvel and DC raised their prices from 40 cents to 50 cents. Check out the original covers to this mini. The first two issues are 40 and number 3 is 50. 2 months after that, Marvel increased their story page count from 17 in a standard length comic to 22. DC went to 25, hence the Joe Staten extra in the last issue. Ah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Scott. That tends to make me believe John Byrne's window availability you discussed was closed by an increased workload at Marvel. The first X-Men stories with the new length were the famous Days of Future Past issues, 141 and 142. And if you compare them to the issues earlier that year leading up to Death of Phoenix, you'll notice a marked increase in the number of panels with solid color backgrounds. If you didn't have time for backgrounds, you didn't have time for side projects. The only reason that stories from the first two issues were as long as they were was, I suspect, that they sacrificed in-house ads to accommodate a story intended for a 64-page format. Again, I'd have to dig them out to check. And yes, the Huntress backups feature was the only reason to buy Wonder Woman at the time. As weird as it was, the Roy Thomas Gene Colan version that followed was a step up. Thank you for all that detail, Scott. That's I really appreciate it. Derek William Crabb says, very happy for you, Rob, with this and Justice League of America number 200 on the horizon, plus the additional podcast coverage that follows. I feel like the gift that's going to keep on giving. Normally, I wouldn't even put X-Men New Teen Titans down as a possibility, but with all the recent crossovers, I'll just voice it so it manifests. That's the one I'd love to see the most as a Treasury edition. Yeah, Derek, like, they have to do it. They have to do it. It's too perfect, right? It's too perfect. Everyone knows who the Teen Titans are. Everyone knows who X-Men are, especially with Doomsday coming. And you're doing all the crossovers. Just do it, DC. Come on, just do it. Edo Boznar says, great show about what I'm sure is a great looking book. I'm also old enough to have picked up the series off the spinner rack back in the day and absolutely adored it and ate it all up. To this day, everything that's outlined here is still pretty much my own headcanon for Batman. As for the cover used for the Treasury Edition, even though I'm one of those guys who generally prefers covers that reflect the story inside, and I don't mind dialogue bubbles on covers, I still think the best choice would have been the cover to the third issue of the original mini. Both the image and the lettering of the title logo just seem more suited to the Treasury format. In conclusion, it's good to hear we'll have some more Treasury cast to look forward to in the coming months. P.S. You may be right that Staten isn't necessarily a Batman artist, but he did do the art on what I consider one of, or possibly the best Batman stories ever from Brave and the Bold number 187, in case anyone's wondering. Yes, that's one story by Alan Brenner. You all know how I feel about Alan Brenner. That is one of the great Batman stories of all time. So, yes, I just was sort of saying Staten is just not known as a Batman artist. He's done some Batman stories. He's just not like an Aparo or Newton or somebody that you immediately associate with the character. So I was just kind of wondering, why was he given this 3-page detail when he probably could have asked Aparo to do it? Whatever. Anyway, Martin Gray comes back and he says, great show, Rob and Chris. It's very strange that neither of you two saw this miniseries on sale as kids. It even made it to the UK newsagents. I really enjoyed the series. Seeing John Byrne on Batman was a treat. He and Aparo really did make a great team on that first issue. Still, no complaints about Aparo going solo after the first. And Len Wein did as good a job as could be expected. Shame about the wrap-up explained that Batman was his own worst enemy. Heck, even an anniversary tribute trick from Batmite would have been preferable to the concussed Crusader. As regards Len Wein fleshing out Gotham City, I remember that when Paul Levitz took over from Julie Schwartz as editor, he said in the letter call that that's exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted us to know the streets of Gotham like our own home. I'm likely imagining that we got a map. Oh, Chris, I've told you a million times. I bought Wonder Woman for the Adventures of the Amazon Princess, not the Huntress. It seemed weirdly random having an Earth 2 Bat character in an Earth 1 book. I enjoyed the shorts well enough, but for me, they were a bonus, not the main event. I really enjoyed Jerry Conway, Jose Delbo, Diana. Bring back Mother Juju. I don't know what that means. We'll just keep going. Mark Baker Wright says, while I might not have gone so far as Chris, and apparently others, as to say the Huntress backups were the only reason folks bought Wonder Woman back in the day, I must confess that I went to the trouble of buying the trade paperback that collects those backup stories, but have never purchased a Wonder Woman trade paperback in my life. Joe X says, I was lucky enough to get this series new off the racks at the Alpha Beta, where they also carried Treasury-sized books. I first read that Lou Moxon story in my cousin's Pizza Hut reprint. Love it. Signalman's, I love Pizza Hut. Signalman's last appearance before this was Detective 466 from 76, and the Spooks was Tech 488, fairly recent, so that might have been something that they sent Byrne for reference. Good, again, good detective work, Joe. That makes a lot of sense. And then finally, from this very network, Paul Kien says, great episode. This comic was indeed a treat, although they stretched it a bit by calling it a facsimile. It really is a Treasury-sized trade paperback. I do have the original issues, and they cherry-picked the ads they put in, which is fine. I'm glad they included any. Most wanted Treasury reprints for me. Action 500, easy. JLA three-parter by Buckler, 210 to 212. Batman 400 and or Detective 526. Another vote for Detective 526. Yeah, all those would be fantastic. Super, I would think Superman 400, Batman 400, all stuff would be great. But yeah, the JLA three-parter, after JLA 200, the JLA three-parter would be my number one pick, simply because, as I've said, we've talked many times, it was meant to be a Treasury. It's right there, and I'm just never going to turn down more and more JLA Treasury. So thanks so much, Paul. Thank you, everybody, for the comments. I really do appreciate it. So one last thing I want to mention before we sign off. Last episode, I asked for some Apple Podcast reviews, because the show, even though the show's officially still dormant, we haven't had any new ones in a while, and I just thought it would be fun to see a couple of new Apple Podcast reviews. And a bunch of you really stepped up. I really appreciate it. So I want to read those reviews, because you were nice. These people were nice enough to log on to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, and I want to highlight those. Mitch Halleck simply says, better than a Slurpee and a Ma Kent cup. That's a compliment. Thank you, Mitch. I'm pointing right now. William McElroy says, big comics and big fun. 5 stars. If you remember reading the big Treasury size comics of the 70s and 80s, this podcast is right up your alley. Host Rob Kelly and a succession of knowledgeable guests discuss these classic Marvel and DC comics with both nostalgia and affection. Highly recommended. Thank you so much, William. And then finally, Timidoc, or Trinidoc, leaves a 5-star review, and he says, extremely entertaining, nostalgia fueled podcast. Okay, Rob, you asked for it. This I did. This was my first comic related podcast, and boy, did I pick a good one. If you love the Treasury format like I do, you've got to listen to this. Rob and his guests are super entertaining, and their love for the format is infectious. I've binge listened to all 100 plus shows, and they are all great. They weren't all great. Thanks for a fun walk down memory lane, Rob. Well, thank you, Timidoc. I really appreciate it. And thank you, William McElroy. And thank you, Mitch Halleck, for the reviews. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to just mention this. At some point between the recording of the last episode and this one, I was having like a really bad day. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't anything terrible, but I was just having like a lousy day, and I was feeling a little down about something. I don't even remember. And I absentmindedly looked up Treasury Cats on Apple Podcasts just to see if anyone left reviews like I had so pathetically asked for. And there were these 3 reviews, and it really made me feel good. And so, you know, not to be all corny, but like, go out and do kindness, everybody, even something small like this, because it really lifted my spirits that A, I knew that people were actually listening and that they liked the show enough to go and make the effort to do this. And just seeing these nice words, it really made me feel good. So it just hit at the right moment. Maybe at another day that had been a relatively normal day, I would have been like, oh, that's great, and moved on. But this, it was really valuable, because I was just feeling kind of low, and to see these really lifted my spirits. So thank you all for the Apple Podcast reviews. I really, really do appreciate it. So speaking of appreciating, of course, I really appreciate my pal, Dr. Ange, friend of the network, friend of humanity, for coming on the show and doing so much legwork and compiling these Supergirl stories and writing that editorial. It was just terrific. And, you know, why DC isn't doing Supergirl Treasury, I don't know, but maybe they will at some point, and maybe we'll provide the template for it. And let's all hope that the Supergirl movie is really good. I enjoyed the Superman movie. I hope Supergirl's just as good and adds to the greater canon of the new DCU movies. And more importantly, I hope Ange enjoys it more than I enjoy. I hope Ange just has a great time. I hope Ange walks out of that satisfied, as like, hey, finally got a really good Supergirl movie. So again, big thanks to him for doing it. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the feedback. Thank you all again for the reviews. And as I mentioned the last episode, we will be back next month at some point. I don't know if it's going to be at the end of July or the very beginning of August, covering Justice League of America number 200. I am so excited to get my hands on that book. And there is just no way we will not be doing an episode of the show on it. So I will try and get to record it, and me and my guests get to it as soon as possible. And it comes out on July 22nd. So timing wise, I just might not be able to get to it before the end of July, but guaranteed it'll be either end of July or the very beginning of August. So anyway, that's it. Thank you all so much for listening. We will see you in a month-ish or so. But until then, go big or go home.
Sir, I think your cousin has returned.
Yep.
What the hell, dude? Why did you move the door?
I didn't move the door.
Hey, where is my dog?
Okay, well, this is why he has behavioral issues.
No boundaries. It's not healthy, is it?
Come on. Thanks for watching him, bitch!